Frank Mink became a skinhead when he was just 13. He roamed the country as an Aryan leader and neo-Nazi recruiter. Now, he's a civil rights activist. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, we'll talk with Frank Mink and filmmaker Christian Day. Day is documenting Mink's journey through Iowa as he searches for his spirituality. Before that, we'll talk with Scott Thompson, the writer and director of A Place for Heroes. That's a World War II film being shot in the Iowa towns of Traer and Cloutier. Also, Cecilia Podaski, a resident helping with the production. That's all coming up this hour after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For the past several weeks, small towns in Tama County in central Iowa have been turned into Hollywood-style movie sets. Movie crews are in Traer and Cloutier, shooting the bulk of a World War II film called A Place for Heroes. In just a moment, we hope to be talking with the director, writer and director of that film. But first of all, let's talk with Cecilia Podaski. She's a resident of Tama County, helping out with the production of A Place for Heroes, joining us by phone. Cecilia, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I understand you're working on the film right now. What are you doing?
Well, right now I'm on my way to the Des Moines airport to pick up Daniel Roebuck, who is one of the stars in the film.
Okay, so I understand the film has been shooting for several weeks. What have been your tasks?
I'm basically a gopher.
Okay.
Going here and going there. We've been, Ardeen Cross, who is the mayor of Cloutier and the local representative there, as I am of Traer, we've teamed up and we pick up people at the airport. We pick them up from the hotels and take them to location. And we've been providing food, the meals for them, at least two meals a day, every day, for the crew and the cast. So, it's kept us busy.
How big of a group is that, crew and cast?
We usually fix for about 25 at least each day.
Mm-hmm. What for you have you been present at any of the shooting, or are you out gophering?
yes, I had the opportunity to be there on Tuesday at the Traer Memorial Building when they were filming the final scenes. With the veterans and Paul Sorvino, who gave a very moving speech, and it was well accepted by all the veterans that were there. I know they gave him a round of applause afterwards, and it's just been interesting to see how movie making takes place.
Mm-hmm. How many local people have been involved in this production?
Oh, gosh. In the actual, filming of it, you mean the cast? We've had extras in it outside. It's professional people otherwise. But, we've probably had totaling around 30, 40 extras actually in the movie. But then we've had just multiple people from the communities that are helping out in so many ways. They've provided food. They've given us food.
Mm-hmm.
They've provided lodging. All the crew is being lodged in private homes, and some of the cast has also been in some of the private homes. And so there's just been, lots of participation by our community people.
We hope to have the director, Scott Thompson, in just a few minutes, but Cecilia, can you tell us anything about the plot of this film, A Place for Heroes?
Well, I don't know how much time you have to go into a lot of it, but it is about a man who dearly loves his country, the United States of America, very patriotic, and through a series of circumstances, he is unable to enter into World War II because of the girl he loves and trying to protect her.
Cecilia, hold on a moment. I think we had some problems getting hold of us. We have Scott with us now, so let's get it right from the writer and director of A Place for Heroes.
Scott,
you hold on, Cecilia, please. Scott Thompson, are you there?
I sure am. How are you?
Thank you for joining us on River to River. Cecilia was just telling us a little bit about the plot of the film. Perhaps you can pick it up and tell us what this film is about.
Well, without giving away too much of the ending, we want everyone to be weepy at the end. We like to make people cry, we say.
All right, fair enough.
But it's really about a gentleman who had always wanted to serve in the war because of his brother's sacrifice, and one reason leads to another, and he's not able to go. But we don't really know why until the end of the movie, and that's sort of the mystery of the movie and where the emotion comes from. Mm-hmm. So it's a really unique way to talk about the sacrifices that veterans make without making an actual war movie.
Based on any true life experience, inspired by anything in that actually happened?
Inspired by my dad and two uncles, who were all three World War II veterans. All three have passed away. My dad, who was originally from the Estherville area, long time ago, and two other uncles served in the war, had very dramatic stories, and my uncle, Ken Thompson, had always told me that the reason he went to the war was so that he could come home again, and that was sort of a riddle to me when I was younger, didn't understand it till I got older, and now it's become a line in the movie. He's going so that he can come home, meaning that if he didn't go do his service, he didn't think he had a right to come home to the little town he was trying to protect. So I think that pretty much reflects a lot of the spirit of the World War II veteran.
Are there World War II veterans in the area that are perhaps played by extras here or performing the work of extras?
Mm-hmm. There are. We had several come to the scene that Cecilia, I believe, was telling you about with Paul Sorvino. One even wore his original uniform, which was very inspirational. And then there were several that came from the Des Moines area. And then the other veterans were made up of the local veterans, both from Tama County itself and from the Meskwaki settlement. They have a very, very proud veterans heritage there as well. And so we were very honored to have them there.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Scott Thompson of My Town Pictures, writer and director of A Place for Heroes. Cecilia Podaski is also on the phone with us, a resident of Tama County, where they are shooting in the central Iowa county. The film A Place for Heroes have been doing it for the last few weeks. Why, Scott Thompson, did you choose this area, these towns?
Well, Cecilia and her friends there in Tama County, in particular Traer and Cloutier, were overwhelmingly generous to me and my company when we shot two of our little community movies there last year, one in Cloutier called Hometown and one in Traer called The Call. And it seemed like, as I'd been thinking about A Place for Heroes for many years, that it just seemed like Traer and Cloutier would be the perfect place for it. And Cecilia won't tell you herself, but she is our special angel because she has been she's been the busiest person of all of us organizing the homegrown aspects of the movie, the mm-hmm. food that's served every day that she's spoiling us with, and rides to the airport for the stars. They have given us much, much more than any independent film could ever ask for, and I think that's reason enough why it's in Traer and Cloutier.
I imagine some of the storefronts, some of Cloutier and Traer do resemble the way they looked in the 1940s, and other things have changed. How, Scott, do you make these towns vintage World War II?
Well, Traer doesn't have to be. That's sort of the that's why I like to write my own stories. I can sort of write them based on what I know I have. Traer is contemporary portion of the movie. Cloutier is somewhat contemporary portion, but they have the wonderful old hall there, the old Czech hall that was built 100 years ago and really hasn't changed much in that time, and that's going to be our location for the 1943 scenes in the movie, and which we start shooting tomorrow, as a matter.
So you're going back in time tomorrow. Up to this point, it's been the present day?
Exactly. We have a whole new cast coming because it's a whole different time period. And so we're looking forward to an energetic new crop of cast members joining
right.
us tomorrow.
Without giving anything away, of course, as you mentioned, any especially tricky scenes that you as a director have a little bit of adrenaline rush about?
Well, each one of them gives me an adrenaline rush or a stress headache. I don't know which one
right.
of those two. But so the 1943 scenes are especially difficult just because of the time period. The, you know, wardrobe and costume department, makeup department, hair, all those things have to be pretty spot on, and they're doing a really incredible job. You know, the producer, Sam Borowski, and I have been talking about this for some time, and now it's sort of coming together. So we're excited to just get on with these next 5 days, and those are the last 5 days of shooting we have as well.
Right. Scott Thompson, as the writer of A Place for Heroes, I wonder if you had to take into account whether speech has changed in the intervening 60-some years. Has our speech in the Midwest changed? Do people talk differently?
I think a little bit, although, you know, you're always showing your movie to a contemporary audience, so you can get away with some contemporary speak, but you can't get away with using euphemisms that weren't used in the 40s. So, you know, there's some euphemisms that were more popular then than now that were thrown in there, but generally we try to steer clear of language that dates the movie, even though it's supposed to be set in 1943, it has to relate to people today. So you kind of walk a fine line as a writer. You know, you can be very exact if you want to, but you risk then making the movie inaccessible to a contemporary audience, and vice versa. You know? So you
right.
walk a fine line.
You've been on location here in Iowa for how many weeks now?
Well, it seems like 6 or 7, probably, to Cecilia and I, but it's only been a couple.
Okay.
And one to go.
One more week to go, and then you'll be done, and you're on schedule.
Yes, we're on schedule so far, and the heat is going to be playing a factor with us the next couple of days, but plenty of water and chance to get out and get a couple of breaks will help a lot. And so our shooting schedule is light the next 2 days. And that should help.
In that big hall, you mean the heat will be a factor?
Yeah, because it's old. There's no air conditioning in there. So luckily we're shooting most of those scenes at night after it cools down a bit. But it holds the heat, so we'll still have to find places to cool off the actors and the camera and the crew and give them plenty of water breaks and make sure that they're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of our task, Sam and I. You know, to make sure that everyone has what they need. And then Cecilia and her crew will do their usual excellent job of providing us the water and the refreshment.
After this week and you're done with the shooting on location here in Iowa, what happens then next, Scott? How many steps until it's completed?
Well, then Sam and I will start going through it. I'll do the content editing, meaning, you know, as far as storyline goes, and then we'll start talking about, you know, the music. He's got some ideas for music and graphics and a number of other things, and we're just trying to then we're starting to do the polishing of it, and that'll take a while. You know, the post-production on a film takes longer than the production of it if you're going to do it right.
Months?
This was shot so well, we need to make it look as good as possible.
Will it take months, done before the end of the year, early next year?
I'm hoping that we'll start having sneak previews of it in Iowa next spring, just prior to Memorial Day. But we'll also be sending it out to film festivals around the country.
Right. That was my next question. Where will it be seen? Where do you hope it will be seen?
It will be seen around the country, at least in film festivals. And then I think we're all pretty confident that distributors will be wanting to see it just because of the excellent cast that we have. Sam Borowski brought his contacts with Paul Sorvino, Sally Kellerman, Daniel Roebuck, Robert Fralgo, Harold Sylvester. We added Norman Lloyd and Salome Jensen in there. You know, it's really a remarkable cast for a small-budget movie in Iowa that was homegrown.
How big is the budget?
And everything.
How big is the budget?
Well, we don't go into exact figures, you know, but let's just say it's far less than a movie with this kind of star power to it would normally have. And one of the big reasons for that is both the relationships that Sam had with some of the actors previous, but also because of the tremendous in-kind support we've gotten from the Meskwaki settlement, from Cecilia and her friends and investors in Traer. It's very much a homegrown project. People should know there isn't a dime of funding for the movie that came from outside of Iowa. We haven't asked for tax incentives. We haven't raised any money from New York or Hollywood. Everything is homegrown, and almost all of it in Tama County, which is remarkable, and they should be very proud.
Cecilia Podaski, you're a resident of Tama County, helping out with this production of A Place for Heroes. Before we go, tell me, after this week, back to your former life as?
My former life was a different kind of craziness. I watch my grandchildren. I volunteer at school and community things. And, you know, there'll be a void there. It'll be kind of like an empty nest after the crew and cast leave because they're such wonderful people. And we've gotten attached just over this short time. But, yeah, and anxiously awaiting to see what this finished product is going to be.
Well, maybe, Cecilia, this is the beginning of a second career for you in the film business. Would you like that?
I don't think so.
Okay. Cecilia, thank you for joining us. Scott Thompson, good luck with the rest of your shooting. Thank you for this conversation. Scott Thompson of My Town Pictures, writer and director of A Place for Heroes.
Thank you
very much.
Bye-bye.
This is River to River. Now, for the rest of the hour here on River to River, we'll discuss skinhead and neo-Nazi culture with my guests Frank Mink and Christian Day. Frank Mink became a skinhead at the age of 13. He roamed the country as an Aryan leader and neo-Nazi recruiter with gangs that would beat people indiscriminately. By the age of 18, he was doing hard time in a maximum security prison in Illinois. But while behind bars, Frank Mink began to question his hatred, thanks in large part to his African-American teammates on a prison football league. Mink left the white supremacy movement after being paroled and eventually moved to Iowa. Frank Mink is author of the 2010 autobiography of a recovering skinhead. Christian Day is a Des Moines-based filmmaker. His latest project is a documentary featuring Frank Mink as Frank tries to find a sense of spirituality in Iowa. The documentary is called Is This Heaven? They have a Kickstarter campaign and are attempting to raise $15,000 for the project. Christian Day, Frank Mink, welcome to our program in our Des Moines studio.
All right, thanks for having us.
And thank you.
Frank, we've had you on the program before. It's been a couple years, but I'd like to start with a little bit of your biography. By the age of 16, you were a skinhead, a gang leader, on the East Coast. Tell us about your life a little bit before that time and what led you to that path.
Yeah, no, I grew up in South Philadelphia in a very kind of Irish Catholic ghetto. And my mother had gotten remarried to a guy who was not really a good human being and liked to put his hands on me, you know, physically. And so that relationship wasn't working out real well. So at 13, they sent me to go live with my father, who my dad is kind of, at the time, was just a drug dealer and kind of had this little bar, and I kind of roamed the streets. And I had to go to an all-black school, going from a very diverse school to an all-black school. I learned that I had to fist fight a lot more. So this little bit of hate. And I did have black friends in school, but, you know, obviously as a kid, you kind of more remember the things that cause you pain and fear. And so I hated going to that school. I hated some of the kids I went to school with. And that kind of really started the, wow, maybe we're different. And my cousin was into the skinhead thing. So
with that difficult background, then, was there a moment, a day, when you were brought in to a skinhead gang?
Yeah, no, they. I was hanging out with skinheads a lot this one summer, probably the summer of 89, and a lot of the skinheads were hanging out, and I got to hang with them, but I was still like a little skateboarder kid hanging around with them. But finally one day they asked me if I shaved my head. I had, you know, kind of proved to them that I was kind of a cool kid, and And this was out in the suburbs of Philadelphia in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, so in the Amish section of town. And so these white kids are up there. They never even really seen black people. They hated them, but they never really seen them. Well, I'm the white kid that lived around black people, so they used to always talk to me about all that stuff. And they kind of liked me, and they asked me if I had shaved my head one night. And obviously I was, at the time, you know, sadly, I was honored to be part of anything.
Mm-hmm. Honored for what reason?
You know, someone wanted me. You know, neither of my parents wanted me. I was a throwaway kid at 13, and, you know, someone was saying, hey, we want you around us. And, you know, they would ask me about my life. You know, my parents never asked me about my life. Even when I came home from school, I never heard, hey, Frank, how's school today? Now these guys are asking me, hey, what's it like growing up down there in the black neighborhoods? And to me, they were just asking me, hey, Frank, how's life? These skinheads are asking me this stuff. And it felt good. It felt good to have people ask me about me and want to know about me. And, you know, I was a scared, I was a fearful human being. So once I really got into the skinheads, it was because I seen people had fear. When I loved that feeling. I loved when people feared us.
When you walked through the streets, you saw people's expressions, and that gave you a great feeling.
Yeah. I mean, up until that moment of me joining the skinheads, I feared everything in life. I feared going back to my parents' house. I feared going to school. I feared if I was going to have enough food to eat today. And now someone fears me, like, in a sick way. I'm 13 going on 14 years old. Mm. I love that.
And once you're in the group, this skinhead group in Philadelphia, what were your ideas, your beliefs about people outside the group, whatever their skin color?
I mean, if you weren't of the white race, I you know, did not think well of you is the best way. And it could be from what they would consider the mud races, which was anyone that wasn't white, period. And then there's, you know, obviously there was the Jew element of it, where everyone kind of hated the Jews and preached against the Jews and every chance they got. So all these things were kind of backed up. Now I would go to Bible studies and learn about how the Jews were so evil. And then I would go out to Bible studies and learn how to shoot guns. Now I'm 14 years old, and these older men are showing me, like, this is how you shoot my gun. This is at Bible studies.
Mm-hmm. And you received that information without any evidence, or did they provide some sort of evidence?
Oh, I mean, they had their own evidence, just like everyone has an interpretation of the Bible. These guys had their own interpretation, and when they would tell me the story of Adam and Eve and how Eve was seduced by a demon in the garden, not tricked by a snake, and that's how the first Jew came to be, and that was Cain. Okay, I was born and raised Irish Catholic, and I could tell you that Sister Mary Agnes and Father Wassel never taught me that story out of the Bible that they did, but I wanted to believe it. And I remember asking, though, if I asked the questions, why have I never heard this, and why does the rest of the world not know this? They say, because God chose you to know the truth now.
Frank Mink is my guest, along with Christian Day. Frank Mink is a former skinhead, and we'll hear more of his story when we come back, and also how he met Christian Day, a Des Moines-based filmmaker. They're working on a documentary featuring Frank Mink as he goes through Iowa searching for spirituality, and we'll find out what that's about. The documentary is called Is This Heaven? They have a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for that documentary. When we come back, I'll ask Frank Mink about his typical day as a skinhead and prison and what turned his life around into someone who helps reform other neo-Nazis and skinheads, and how this documentary fits into his life. If you have questions about Frank Mink's story, questions about skinhead and neo-Nazi culture, 1-866-780-9100. Give us a tweet at IPR Talk, or Iowa Public Radio is where you can find our email. Back in just a minute. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests, Frank Mink, reformed skinhead, and Christian Day, a Des Moines-based filmmaker, joining us in our Des Moines studio. Frank and Christian, I wanted to have you pick up with your story. I want to get to the present day, of course, to talk about your work with Christian Day. But tell us a little bit more about a typical day for you as a skinhead in your teens.
You know, a real typical day was I was a lonely, scared, violent human being who also fell into alcoholism pretty young. I mean, that's the real version of who I was. But, you know, what I think what we're trying to talk about is that, you know, my life every day was full of hatred. You know, we didn't sit around and talk about, you know, sports anymore or, you know, of course we talk about girls. But, you know, mainly our conversations were about the other races and how they are destroying this white nation. And it would fuel our hate for our everyday lives. And everyday life for us was also violence. We lived for and we got accolades from each other from violence.
So you would drink heavily, discuss these things, then go out and find victims.
And we would always have people looking for us too, because obviously when you cause trouble, you have people that are now looking for you. So we'd have like the left wing, the militant left wing groups looking to, you know, split our head open too. So it was like a big gang cat and mouse game.
You were sent to prison for 3 years. What was the sentence, or what was the reason you were sent to prison?
I got sentenced to 3 years. I only did about a year, but I was sentenced for aggravated kidnapping. I kidnapped a left-wing guy in Springfield, Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And I understand beat him senseless and also videotaped it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You had a turning point in prison, and I believe that was in Illinois. What was that turning point?
You know, there was a couple of things that were happening where a lot of the kids I was hanging with in this adult prison were kind of the same age as me, but they happened to be black kids from Chicago and East St. Louis. And I still ran with the Aryan Nations guys in prison, but when I went to play sports, I would play sports sometimes with the Aryans. And when you're playing basketball with bikers from Southern Illinois, you know, the great joke is you kind of let double dribbling go. You kind of let traveling go sometimes because those guys don't play that game. And I grew up my whole life playing basketball, football, hockey, just being a South Philly kid. And so when I seen the black kids had better games going, sometimes I go over and say, hey, let me play. And so I play football once in a while with some of the black kids, and it was mostly all black kids on both teams and black guys. And they learned real quick that I was pretty good, and I got kind of a starting job on a roster. And, you know, here's the funny thing. They didn't call me Frank or they didn't call me Skinhead anymore. They all just called me Steve, and that was the name that kind of just stuck. And they all called me Steve because, you got to remember, this is 1993, 94. They all call me Steve due to Steve Largent, like the little white wide receiver for the Seattle Seahawks. And that was just the name that stuck because I was a good wide receiver. So, you know, I just started making friends with a lot of those guys. When you play sports every day and you're competitive with each other, that kind of is what just started to happen.
And I understand the bombing in Oklahoma City a couple years later, 1995, a real turning point for you. Why?
Well, in between that time, there was one other thing that happened to me, and that was when I got out of prison. I had a swastika tattooed on my neck, and a Jewish man gave me a job working in the antique business on the East Coast.
Wow.
And he just turned out to be this like incredible human being. And what I started to notice in those times was the people that I started to relate more with were people that were showing me compassion. Mm. Anytime that people would show me compassion, no matter what my beliefs were, I started to like you. And if you didn't like it or not, that's just what happened. And so when Oklahoma City bombing happened, I'd already been out of the movement. And the picture of that fireman with the little girl, and she's all bloody and she's just dangling from his arms, is something that forever has changed my life to where I said, I'm not going to support or even just turn a blind eye to this movement anymore. I know that inner gut feeling of hatred that drives that person every day. And so I started to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you've helped a good deal of youth who seem to be on that course. Christian Day, I'd like to turn to you now. How did this project come about? You are a Des Moines-based filmmaker making a documentary featuring Frank Minc. It's called Is This Heaven? What is the project? How did it come about?
Well, back in April of this year, Frank had just returned from L.A. He was working on a television pilot with AMC that made it to basically the very final tier of executives and then was shot down. And he called me up the day after he got back and said, I'm home. The show has been canceled. And, you know, I've kind of had my cry over. I'm done. But there's some stuff, you know, that's kind of going on in my head right now in politics. And, you know, that's as soon as you get down to the politics, it's like, okay, are you ready to sit down and go for it? But he said something very interesting that had been going through my head was there's been a lot of talk from the Christian right that's really made myself question who I am. All through Frank's life, he's always been a Christian, even before he was a skinhead and after he was a skinhead. And he said, you know, I'm starting to look at other faiths and practices because I don't think I'm a Christian anymore because I don't want to follow any of this. And I said, well, you know, you're very lucky here in Iowa. There are many types of faiths. And we have a lot of areas here, such as the Maharishi University in Fairfield. We have Mother Mosque, the oldest staying mosque in North America, which is located in Cedar Rapids. We have one of the largest Hindu temples in North America in Madrid. We have so many representatives of different faiths here. And I've been on the road quite a bit. I've been touring my last film, the Templeton Rye documentary, and I've been able to visit a lot of these towns. I mean, we even have Al-Qaeda, which is named after the George Washington of Algeria, who is a Muslim. And I don't think people really realize that some of these places are here. So I said, yeah, this would be a great project for us to hit the road on and document this. I'm very curious myself. I am actually an atheist. I'm not an angry atheist. I'm very open to learning about all these different faiths here in Iowa. And with Frank kind of being on a mission of his own, I thought that would be a perfect basically a perfect recipe for a film project. And a series I'd been working on that started two films back, which was the Made in Iowa documentary series. It started with the Hybrid Pioneer and then went into the two Templeton Rye films. This would be a great step, you know, for something different and completely left field from what Templeton Rye was. Mm-hmm. You know, Templeton was a very historical piece. This is very guerrilla, very here and now, and we don't really know what the end is going to be. You know, we're both
in this documentary project. Frank is going from place to place, from various places of faith, Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids or Maharishi University in Fairfield, to find out what is that faith and his reaction to it.
And what am I? Thing that I'm trying to find is I know that there's this inner compassion in me that I want to show towards the human race, and what I wasn't getting or seeing from you know, the Rick Santorums of the world. So I wanted to start finding something that maybe matches that compassion I have inside me. So that's kind of one of the things. And we're also doing stuff with Christianity. It isn't a knock against Christianity mm-hmm. at all. We've actually interviewed some great pastors and, you know, rabbis. We've done you name it already. We've already gone and interviewed and asked, like, as a person like me, how do I convert? What do I do? So even if there's someone that's watching this documentary, they can watch it and learn, because we ask all the basic questions that anyone would ask that's going to join or think of a religion.
Frank, what would you say is your faith right now?
My faith is humanity. I mean, really, that's where it is right now. It's totally in humanity. I'm really interested in going back to the Maharishi. I'm very interested in doing that once this documentary project is over, maybe doing it before it's over. But, like, today we went and did the Buddhist. And, you know, it's funny is every day when I do something, like the last week we did a lot of stuff with the rabbis and synagogues, I feel like, oh, that's what I want to do. And then mm-hmm. I'll go to the Buddhist temple and I'm like, oh, maybe that's what I want to do. So I'm really, you know, just giving
everything. So what did you do, for example, at the Buddhist temple? What did you actually – someone show you how to practice Buddhism in some sense?
A little bit they showed us, but we have in this temple here where we were, they have three living monks that they all take care of. So we learned just the stories and the interesting parts of why they have a temple. I mean, the Buddhist monk, and like every there's no temple in the world that is Buddhist that has no monk. They have to have a monk to be a temple, and they all have to take care of the monk. And I mean, this very interesting stuff. So that's what we were just learning about, that and about compassion, because I really want to get down to the heart of where I don't see how anyone can use their religion to tell someone else they're going to hell. And so that's kind of why I'm like trying to see what this person believes, and almost all of them believe the same thing. Like, I can't tell you you're going to go to hell, but there seems to be some radio pundits on the other side that love saying that there's certain types of people who commit what they believe is sin going to hell, and I just can't buy into that.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're seeking a spiritual life as a as a redemption for what you did earlier to people as a practicing skinhead?
No, I'm done with – I mean, really, it's been 20 years. I've built inner-city hockey programs from the Anaheim Ducks to the Dallas Stars to the Philadelphia Flyers. I have participated in and took part in a lot of stuff for gay rights already to do, make an atonement for my hate crimes against that community. I can't say that I'm going to walk around with this guilt on my shoulder all the time, because I think that whatever God is up there has forgiven me, because he has given me many blessings since my years of the skinheads. And so now it's just a part of, I see hatred coming up in the mainstream. The same things I hear coming from the Christian right sometimes is the same thing I used to hear at Bible studies at Aryan Nations. So now I just want to point that out and say that I think that we're better than that.
Mm-hmm. Christian Day, as a filmmaker, why do you find Frank Minc, obviously a fascinating character, a real-life person, not a character, but why is he a fascinating person to have take a sampling of various faiths?
Well, because he has been, both a savior to some people and a villain to other people at the same time. I think this is the perfect person to be out there, and he's lived both sides of the fence. You know, I mean, when we sat down, we were listening to speeches of certain individuals here in the state, and we were comparing them to some of the speeches that he had when he was in the hate movement. I mean, it was almost word for word. They actually changed out one group of people for the other, and it was absolutely amazing. And when he told me, he's like, I can smell hate, I can taste it. This is hate. I'm thinking if I was ever going to make a film that was advocating or some type of view, this is the guy that should be leading it. I mean, this is him.
Mm-hmm. Very strong words, I anticipate, from what you're saying. Do you anticipate any pushback, reaction?
I would hope so. You know, if we don't get any pushback, we're not doing our job.
Okay. What about you, Frank?
You know, I already get pushback now from some of those groups, even from the still large neo-Nazi websites who, you know, try to post my address and threaten me. To someone, when I told a Christian right, a very far Christian right friend of mine, this project that I'm working on, first thing he said was, "Well, you know, you're going to hell for that." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because you're going to go worship first false gods and try and trick other people." And right there, I said, "That's exactly why I'm making it, because I just can't live with that." So, I mean, I've already got pushback from it.
Frank, have you ever feared for your life, for your safety, because of speaking out, whether it be against skinheads or in this latest project?
No, I mean, I always do, and I try to take precautions in my life to keep myself safe. I don't know what else to do. I'm not going to fear them enough that I'm going to shut up to not talk about it. But like a lot of people say that are in the hate group, that are still in the hate group, no one's ever gone to prison for anything I've ever said. I've never ratted on nobody. I've always thrown myself under the bus first and foremost, and continue to do that because I'm a self-deprecating human being. But I never throw the whole neo-Nazi movement under the bus. When I'm working with, because that doesn't help when I'm working with other skinheads that are other neo-Nazis or other hate people that are trying to get out of it, it won't help if I threw them under the bus. See, because my job now isn't to go to a neo-Nazi rally and say, "Hey guys, let me talk to all you guys about these beliefs you got going on." Like, that doesn't work. That's like an alcoholic who is an AA going to a nightclub and saying, "Why everyone's partying still? Hey, let me talk to you about your drinking." Like, that doesn't work. What works is the next morning when a person woke up and they know they drank too much. Well, I'm that guy that when a person wakes up and says, "You know what? This hate has cost me everything. I've lost friends now. I've lost family. They don't want to talk to me because all I do is spout hate." I want to be the guy that they're like, "You know, I might be able to talk to somebody about this."
Mm-hmm. Frank, I'm wondering, do you still live in the Des Moines area?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Frank Minc, if you just joined us, is one of my guests. His 2010 biography is titled, autobiography is called Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Also with us, Christian Day, a Des Moines-based filmmaker. Their latest project together featuring Frank Minc is called Is This Heaven? What haven't we mentioned, Christian Day, about the film that we'd like to talk about? I know you have a Kickstarter campaign attempting to raise money for the project.
Yeah, well, we had some seed money. We originally raised about between six and seven thousand to get the project going, and we've also put in some of our own money on this project. The Kickstarter is a way for other people to get involved to help finish the film. We have a good chunk of it already shot. In fact, we shot today. So the film will be made whether we reach the Kickstarter goal or not. But the Kickstarter, the $15,000 we are trying to raise, is going to make things a lot easier for us. We have a lot of more traveling that we want to do to complete the project. And then, of course, the post-production work. All my films get released on the digital cinema, the DCP format. So there's quite a bit of work that still needs to be done. So this is a way to for everyone to get involved. We have some great benefits for people who donate. And if you just go to Kickstarter, you just type in Is This Heaven? Or even at this point, I think you can probably type in Frank Mink and pull it up and see some of the things we've been doing. We've interviewed Modest Yahoo, the Jewish reggae rapper from L.A. We have some great things in there.
Frank Mink, we want to mention that Frank has an alternative spelling to his last name,
yes.
M-E-E-I-N-K. Is that correct, Frank?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. I was interested to hear you talking about doing a pilot for a reality show for the cable channel AMC, Frank. The idea behind that was what?
We did interventions on people that are still actively in hate groups, and we shot a pilot and the and we shot a sizzle and a pilot reel, and we did a whole episode. And so we had it going. We worked on it for about a year and a half, and AMC had us locked in for about 8 months of that time, maybe 9 months of that time, and then shot us down. And the intervention we had worked. We did it up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they got me in with a guy who still was a very active neo-Nazi skinhead. And I went and lived in his life for a couple of days, and then he came and lived in my life for a couple of days. And at the end, he changed, and he just got married to a Latino girl, and he's a wonderful young man, and I wish him all the best. So it worked, but AMC just didn't think it was going to work for their program this year.
It sounds like a fascinating idea for a reality show series, and also a series that can do some good in our culture. I'm just wondering, did they provide any other reason why they put that on the shelf?
I think they said it was too dark, but I don't believe that. I mean, and I'm not questioning AMC people. I just think they were trying to be nice. How can it be too dark when you see zombies' heads exploding on some of their other shows? So, and I'm a huge AMC fan, and I still am. I have no hard feelings towards them. I don't know. Sometimes you get put in that reality hold, which we try to say unscripted TV anymore, because reality TV is kind of like the Jersey Shore, and we didn't have any Snookies on our show, so that was another kind of detractor, I guess, in the reality world TV.
What is that? Is that idea, that reality show idea, dead forever?
No, I don't think it's dead forever. AMC still owns the rights. You never know. They might come back one day and say, all right, we want it again. So, mm-hmm. But they own the pilot, so I can't take it anywhere else. I'm not allowed. They paid us a certain amount of dollars to make the show, and we made it, and now they own the rights to that show. So they just sit on it unless I want to go to them with X amount of dollars and say, hey, I want that pilot back, and then I could shop it around. But obviously I'm just a guy in Iowa, and
right. Frank Mink, are you still doing some work with troubled youth?
Oh, yeah. No, I work for a great organization called Life After Hate, which is all other formers of mostly neo-Nazi groups. And we do this stuff all the time. I do a lot of stuff at juvenile detention centers, which is kind of where my heart is when I do most of my speaking. But I also do like a lot of colleges, and I'm out there. I work with people, both drug and alcohol, and also people that are dealing with gangs and hate.
Some people listening across Iowa might say, wow, hate groups in Iowa? I don't see them in my neighborhood, but they are present here.
Oh, they're present everywhere, no matter where you want to go, especially in a time like this with the economy. Whenever the economy is not doing good in any country on this planet, hate groups get big whenever the economy is not good. It's just a fact. But yeah, they're here. And, we know there's some Klan over on the west side, and You know, and then there's ones that even Southern Poverty Law say that are hate groups that we don't consider hate groups. The Family Leader is one of them groups that is considered a hate group.
Frank Mink, I want to thank you very much for this discussion. Christian Day, thank you also for coming into our Des Moines studio. Their latest project together, Frank Mink, featured in a documentary being shot at present called Is This Heaven? You can find them more information about that on the web under the Kickstarter campaign. Frank and Christian, thank you very much. I think we have a little bit of Matis Yahoo to go out with.
Nice.
I want to thank you very much for this conversation. River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Julie Englander. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Also help from John Pemble in Des Moines. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Politics Day tomorrow.
It's time for a champion to the soul of the land. Men apart from the sea and sand till the sun comes up again. Time for a champion to